Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we'll tell the story of a remarkable woman, a Holocaust survivor, still going strong at the age of 108. But first, a postscript to the election, a look at American women as voters and candidates in the just-completed American election. Women played an important role. We're going to spend some time talking about that. And joining me in studio is Dana Stock, whose Ph.D. is in political science. She is the manager of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Gwyneth Williams is a political science professor at Webster University. A few quick facts. A record number of women ran for political office this year. Women outvoted men nationally and were considered decisive in re-electing President Obama. Five women won U.S. Senate seats Tuesday, giving women 20% of the Senate seats. Campaign helped by Senator Patty Murray, chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. And 78 women were elected to the House of Representatives. That is an all-time high. And finally, New Hampshire will have an all-female congressional delegation and governor come January. Quite a set of stats. And Gwyneth, I'll start with you. Is this an anomaly, or are we going through a seismic shift in the way we do politics?
Well, it could be that neither of those statements would be accurate. I mean, clearly, women are moving up the ladder. Women are more and more women in business, more and more women in politics. Women have been a majority of the electorate for some time. More women get college degrees than do men. More women attend college than do men. So all of those things are going to mean that there are going to be more women in politics. And I think, you know, what the question is, of course, is what effect will it have on politics? Because there have been a number of theories about why you want more women in politics. One is that they can have different experiences and therefore different points of view than men. Another theory is simply you want representatives that mirror the nation. In other words, you want your elected people to represent the demographics of the nation. It's certainly the case that when we talk about women in politics, we want to remember that women aren't just an undifferentiated mass. You know, a lot of headlines that, you know, women gave the election to Obama, that there was a gender gap again in the vote. And that's definitely true, but not all women voted for Obama. Married white women were more likely to vote for Romney, though not in as great a numbers as married white men. So there is still a gender gap. There's a gender gap not only among whites, but there's a gender gap among Latinos that was amplified this year. But you can't just assume that because someone is a woman that she's going to have a specific ideology or viewpoint now. There's a lot more diversity ideologically among the women who hold office.
And yet, Dana, there is a tendency, I think, on most people's part to speak of it as a monolithic group, that they're all exactly the same.
It's true. It's true. And I think also there's a tendency to look at the national level, and we should be very excited about the gains that were made at the national level, obviously. But the country as a whole isn't always moving in that same direction. So in Missouri, for example, the number of women in the Missouri House will decrease, will go to 38, possibly 39. The number of women in the Senate will decrease. For the first time in a number of years, we will not have a woman in one of the state constitutional offices. So there's still work to be done.
Still a lot of work to be done. I mean, women have had the vote for 100 years now, and look at what we're talking about, an excitement over a 20% level in the U.S. Senate, for instance.
Right.
Any other messages coming out of what we saw on Tuesday that you can think of?
If we're wanting to talk about the Tuesday elections at the federal level, I think there's some interesting things to talk about, not specifically about gender, but about ethnicity. And the other quick and dirty narrative we're hearing is that whites went for Romney, non-whites went for Obama. And a lot of breastfeeding on the part of the Republican Party that we're going to have to reach out to people beyond whites in order to win the next election. And the group that I think Republicans are particularly talking about are Hispanics. And I think that there's a really interesting story here about the Hispanic vote, because George W. Bush had made real inroads into the Hispanic vote as a governor of Texas. A number of Hispanics voted for him. I think he got in his presidential race about a third of the Hispanic vote. But several things happened in the Bush administration that really affected the national vote on Tuesday that I think people don't quite realize. In early 2006, when Congress was majority Republican, the House of Representatives floated the bill to make it federally illegal to be in the nation without documentation. And that bill was presented in the House. And the Senate came up with a compromise bill, which Bush was really pushing, that was a bipartisan bill, had John McCain, had Kennedy, had Brownback, had Graham on, to have the path to citizenship. But the right wing of the Republican Party really mobilized against the Senate bill and the idea of the path to citizenship. And I think that at this point, and particularly after 2010, the part of the Republican Party that that George Bush represented that wanted to be open to immigrants and to Hispanics sort of lost the fight. And by 2008, you simply couldn't win a Republican primary often without being very, very anti-immigration. And I think you saw that again in 2008, where Mitt Romney, in the primaries, in order to solidify the conservative base, was very critical of Rick Perry about pro-immigration things Rick Perry had done. Even Newt Gingrich was reaching out more to immigrants than Romney was. And so, the Hispanic vote didn't just suddenly go to Obama last Tuesday. It's been building up by things that have been done by the Republican Party. And there are a lot of Hispanics that would love to vote Republican because they tend to be social conservatives. But as long as the Republican Party is appealing to its nativist wing, it's not going to get the Hispanic vote.
You know, it's interesting you say that. On the Diane Rehm show earlier today, one of the guests pointed out that the Tea Party is primarily led by women. Dana, does that sound right to you?
Well, I mean, we've seen some high-profile women who have identified with that. I don't know that I would say primarily, but I definitely, as I say, we've seen women in that role. I think it's interesting with respect to Missouri that we haven't seen a lot of the demographic shifts except movement out of the state, losing a congressional district. And in fact, in Missouri, the Republicans, of course, expanded their majority in the legislature, in the House. And the number of women Republicans increased as well, slightly, and not enough to explain that whole the whole gain by the Republican Party. But I think some of that speaks to the fact that we don't have the same demographic shifts in Missouri that are happening around the country with respect to immigrants and the sort.
During the most recent campaign, you heard an awful lot of comment about people making their decisions based on women primarily, making their decisions based on a couple of things, abortion, contraception. And yet the issue at hand, everyone agreed, was the economy. Do you think this was a fair evaluation to say that these are the only things that women cared about, abortion and contraception?
I saw some polling data that said women were primarily concerned about the economy as well. So I think that was a major factor.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, they certainly are concerned about the economy, but when they were looked at by people trying to evaluate what was going to happen, these were the abortion and contraception, Gwyneth, were the only things that were really looked at.
Well, right. And the thing is, there's some, again, you have to sort of disaggregate groups of women. Younger voters in general went for Obama. Unmarried voters in general went for Obama. So, young unmarried women, issues of contraception can be very salient, all right? And then that could make a difference. But say among minority voters who also went for Obama, if you look at, single women, many of minority single women are very strongly pro-life, but they see the Democratic Party as offering more of an economic safety net. And so that pushes their vote into the Democratic column. So, you know, I think it's I think that there are some women who are drawn to the Democratic Party based on social issues. And then there are others who are drawn to it based on the economic issues.
There again, it's dangerous mm-hmm. to ascribe, mm-hmm. you know, one set of feelings to an entire group mm-hmm. such as this.
Well, and also women are about 50-50 divided in terms of their identification of pro-life, pro-choice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are many women who would vote against Democrats because of strong pro-life views.
How much of an influence would you think such things as legitimate rape and binders, some of the things that we kept hearing about during the course of election, how much of an influence, Dana, do you think that had on the female voter?
I think that they were very hot topics in this election. And I think that historically they're thought of as women's issues. I think that they're family issues. They're bigger than simply women's issues. But both parties were mindful of the fact that they needed to win the women's vote, and they were really trying to message in a way that would give them a bump in that area. And I think for some women, they were the defining issue. Not all women, as Dr. Williams has said, the women are not a monolithic group. So for some women, those were very salient. They were very important issues. For other women, it was the economy. For other women, it was just the whole climate of all of these things together and how they played out at the end.
Very quickly, because I have to take a break, do you think women are looked at unfairly in general?
What do you mean looked at unfairly?
In terms of just kind of marginalizing mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. things that women might be interested in, the things that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there are two sides. There are two arguments of this, even among feminists and people who do women's studies. Is it reasonable to talk about something being a woman's issue? There's an argument that, yes, it is, that collectively there are certain issues that have a much bigger impact on women. And then there's the point of view that we shouldn't differentiate. I can see arguments on both sides of that. I do think whenever we're talking about a, quote, women's vote, we're really oversimplifying a very complex
decision. That's kind of what I was getting mm-hmm. at. You agree with that, Dana?
I agree
Dana?
With that. I do.
All right. We'll have to take that break now. We'll do so. We'd like to get our listeners into the conversation as well. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email if you'd like to get into the conversation. What is your view of the, quote, female vote, if you will? STLpublicradio.org, the email address. Send us a tweet at STL on Air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. My guest in studio, Dana Stock of the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life, and Gwyneth Williams, who is a political science professor at Webster University. Back in just a moment to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about women in politics. My guest in studio, Gwyneth Williams, political scientist, professor, I should say, at Webster University. Dana Stock is with the Sue Scheer Institute for Women in Public Life. Let me go back to something that you had said, Gwyneth, early on with regard to what women would bring to the political world. A lot of people, and this is unfair, and even as I say it, I know it, say, well, women are nurturers, and they're moms, and they're going to bring something like that to the political world. Is that right?
Well, this has long been part of the discourse of women's participation in politics. I mean, one of the arguments made in favor of women having the vote was they would be more highly moral. They would be, the caretakers of the nation and so forth. I think what you have to differentiate here is between essential nature versus social role. And it's indisputable that women are more likely to be the primary caregivers of children. Okay, that's just an objective statement. They are more likely to have that as a social role than men are. And our social roles, you know, help define our political views. So I do think that because women are more likely to be engaged in primary care of children, that's an issue that they're going to be more attuned to in the political world. Not every woman, all right? And they also might draw different lessons from that because a liberal woman might say, therefore, I need more support from government in terms of providing, you know, medical care for my children or, you know, education. A conservative woman might say, I want lower taxation because I want to have more money left within my family to care for my children. But I do think there are sometimes different orientations based on different social roles. I'm not going to make any argument about innate qualities of women or morality.
But we also know that women bring an inclusive style, that their style, there's research that says their style is a little different. So they have a more inclusive approach to their governing generally, and they tend to champion issues and causes that of underrepresented people and issues that haven't been on the agenda before sometimes. I mean, sometimes they just take on different causes. So in that way, I think they add something different, and whether or not that's influenced by their role as the nurturer or the caregiver, one could argue that influences that heavily.
And I think that's a really important point that Dana is making, because back in the 70s, when the women's movement was saying we need to get more women into politics, we didn't really know at that point what some of the effects would be of women in politics. And one of the arguments was women will have a different style of leadership, but we didn't really know. For all we knew, when women got into leadership, they would act exactly the same way that men do. But there is, as Dana said, a lot of information now that there are some differences in style and in terms of issues that are brought up.
Well, what have we learned from women who have been reached the higher rungs on the ladder? Mm-hmm. Christine Todd Whitman, Jennifer Granholm, mm-hmm. Female governors, for mm-hmm. instance. Have the kinds of things that we're talking about here been borne out by the way that they have conducted themselves in office, Dana?
I think we could look to the role Hillary Clinton has played as Secretary of State mm-hmm. of bringing issues of women's global economic and political empowerment to the forefront as one example that I think of. I don't know, Gwyneth, if you have others.
No, I mean, I think and a lot of those female governors as well have really been known for governing in a bipartisan way and in a much more collaborative way with legislatures and reaching across the aisle and so forth. And it's also the case that a lot of those governors tend to be more moderate politically. Now, I think that's also something that tends to be the case of any governor. But one other thing I want to mention that I think people should know, which is really the good news on this, is that we have a lot of evidence now that when women run for a legislative seat, all things being equal, they are as likely to be elected as men are. And that's something that people don't realize, that assuming there's not an incumbent in the race, they can raise as much money, they are as likely to be elected when it is a legislative seat. We've seen that that's not true in terms of the presidency. But in terms of the legislature, there no longer is an innate disadvantage to being a woman. And sometimes the things that we're talking about can be an advantage in running for a legislative seat if the issues tend to be ones around social policies and education and so forth.
The other thing I would mention, going back to our discussion about the way women govern, I think it's so interesting in New Hampshire that New Hampshire now has two women senators, their congressional delegation of two, they're both women, and now a woman governor. So that will be a great test case to see how these women, all women leadership, what the differences may be.
You know, we've had women who have been in charge in several countries around the world, mm-hmm. too, and I wonder what we have learned from people like Margaret Thatcher and Indira Gandhi, people like that. Did we spot anything with them that might give us a hint as to how a woman might preside over this country?
Well, I think, you know, Margaret Thatcher was one of the figures that people would hold up when they said, you know, women in power won't necessarily govern all that differently from men. She was a very strong, you know, commander in chief and in Great Britain, conservative ideology. I have to confess, I don't know that much about what we know about her leadership style within Parliament.
they called her the Iron Lady. Yeah. I think that gives us a hint.
Well, yeah, yeah. Though it kind of almost any woman had come up through the ranks at that time. Yeah. And so I don't, you know, in these discussions, you're really worried about stereotyping women in terms of women's style. But I think they're also becoming head of state, becoming head of your nation involves a whole different set of sort of political calculations and relationships than being a legislator or even being a governor. There's something different about the template that people put on the head of state, because that person's going to be head of the military. It's just a whole different calculation, and it's one that's still very masculinized. It's a very male template about who can run a country.
Well, she went to war, as I recall. Yeah. She was presided during the Falkland Islands War.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Which brings to another question that that people ask. Dana, I'll put this to you. If a woman were president of this country, would we be less likely to go to war than if a man were president at the same time under the same conditions?
Gee, I'm so glad you picked me to answer that question. You threw me the doozy of the morning. It's hard to say. I mean, I think going to war is a calculation that is made based on circumstance. And I believe that a woman, if it was what needed to be done, if she felt that's what needed to be done, she would it's possible that she would choose that path. I think we all assume that women are less hawkish, although we've certainly had women who are very hawkish. So like Condoleezza Rice. So I think that that's a hard question to answer, and it would be based on a lot of circumstances.
But it's a fun question to ask.
It's a fun question.
Well, I think it's also – I mean, the thing about that is the political calculation that a woman who's commander-in-chief has to make, she has to be operating against the stereotype that a woman wouldn't have the guts to take us to war. And that is exactly what hurt Hillary Clinton in the 2008 primaries. She went into those knowing that one of the biggest issues would be, can a woman be head of the military? Is a woman tough enough to be president? And that influenced the vote she had made before about authorizing the invasion of Iraq. And yet that was one of the big criticisms the left made against her in the 2008 primaries, that, you know, Obama had said, you know, I'm against the war in Iraq, and she had been for it. But anyone who studies women in politics would have guaranteed that if she had any aspirations for being president, she had to have voted to go into Iraq. There is no way she could have, you know, thought about making the argument that she was tough enough to be president if she hadn't made that calculated vote at the time. I also think she believed it. But and so then she was in a situation, should she do what John Edwards did and say, well, I regret the vote, which then kind of would make her look like a waffler, or sort of stand by, well, given what I knew, that was the best vote. And that really hurt her in the primaries with the left wing of the Democratic Party. But that's one of the main things a woman has to do if she wants to be head of a country, is she has to seem tough enough.
Does it seem to you that women, and I'll go back to you again, Dana, on this one, that women are somehow easier targets? And I'm thinking right now of Nancy Pelosi, who is really takes a lot of flack. Whether it's justified or not, that's beside that. She really seems to take more than some of her male predecessors. Do you think in any sense they are easier targets, or felt to be easier targets by the person slinging arrows?
Well, I think in political science research, we know that there is this sort of double standard. This women have to be tough enough, but they can't be too tough, or they're called names. So there are a lot. There's a delicate balance that women have to walk, and I think that it's maybe they're easy targets because these are old tropes that we drag out, and the name calling and all that. I think that it is difficult for them to walk that line of being tough enough but not seeming shrill or words I can't say on the air.
Well, yeah, I would agree absolutely, And I think when you see criticism of female political figures, whether it's on the right or the left, they tend to be – the criticisms take on a gender tone. With Hillary Clinton, the criticisms became very much, you know, she's the, you know, overly masculine, unattractive, shrill, you know, hag sort of thing.
I'm glad you're saying this and not me, by the way.
I'm saying this is these were the nasty attacks.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. But attacks came on Sarah Palin too, in a way of delegitimizing her by, she's sort of a Barbie doll and she's just sort of sexy and that kind of thing. So. The attacks become very gendered, I think, on female political figures in a way that they're not against men.
We have a tweet here. Our time is beginning to wind down. A tweet from Adam who asks, who might be the next woman to run for president? You want to put on your political science prognosticator's cap, Dana?
I think Adam has a great question that I'm asking myself because I'm sort of looking out and trying all of the women that were have been named in the past have sort of gone on to do other things or taken themselves out unless I'm missing someone. So I don't know. Do you have a prediction?
I mean, I don't. The conventional wisdom has often been that the first woman president would probably come from the Republican Party because people worry about women being too liberal, so a Republican woman would be seen as, you know, being more acceptable. But some of the women in the Republican Party that are sort of the more prominent figures, like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, are seen as very, very extreme. So, I don't know.
Well, a lot of talk about Hillary in 2016.
Yeah. Yeah, though she'll be in her late 60s by that time, and she says she's tired and wants to do other things. So,
is there a final thought? We're going to have to wind this up. A final thought that you'd like to leave us with, Dana?
I just think that all in all, there were some great things that happened this year, and there's some progress. There are also some things that we lament, but we just keep going and keep leading.
Gwyneth, 15 seconds.
I think it's great that that women made gains, whatever party they were in a lot of the state level offices.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Dana Stock and Gwyneth Williams. Great to have you with us. A very fast segment here, and we will be talking about the world's oldest Holocaust survivor, 108 years old, if you can believe that, in our next segment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.